To call Peter Leach's work historical fiction is to pigeonhole it. Though much of his fiction is set in the past, it is also infused with a kind of old-school socialism, hence the title of his collection, Tales of Resistance. His stories tend to celebrate the common man, the working man resisting the man, but they never romanticize him. My favorite stories contain sinister twists of plot, gritty dialogue, dark, discomforting scenes, and truths about ourselves that can make us wince. While Bill Trowbridge explores the terrain between our nobility and buffoonery, Peter Leach often takes a darker view and explores the area between our nobility and brutality. Tonight's story about Red Kate O'Hare, who served time in the Missouri Penitentiary for saying that World War I reduced women to brood sows for making sons to fertilize the fields of France, thereby running afoul of the Espionage Act, should prove no exception. A returning St. Louis native, Peter Leach has published fiction in Virginia Quarterly Review, Minnesota Review, Nebraska Review, Indiana Review, Kansas Quarterly, Arkansas Review, Artful Dodge, River Styx, coincidentally enough, Best Little Magazine Fiction, and prize stories, the O'Henry Awards. He is the recipient of an NEA for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship. Leach's collection, Tales of Resistance, won the 1998 George Garrett Prize for Short Fiction. Please welcome Peter Leach.
Richard, thank you, and thank you all for coming. And I see some friends of mine that, you know, all due respect to the River Styx series and the fame of our visitor, I think probably came because they're friends of mine. I hope they don't squirm too much. And I'm feeling a little diffident. I'm writing fiction. I'm more long-winded than our thoroughly, I guess I would say it's intelligent hilarity we've just been treated to, that this is a very different matter, and it's going to go on a little. Actually, it's not that much longer, but it is longer. So enough of that. And let's see. Forget about this as soon as I can. Okay, I'm better put my glasses on too. Okay, I'm going to read a story called Serenade about Kate Richards O'Hare, who lived in St. Louis from 1911 to 1923. She was a writer and lecturer managed by her husband, Frank, for the National Ripsaw. The story is told by her son, Dick. It should take about 38 minutes. It might be 37 and it might be 39. So. Serenade. Dad goes up in the cars once a week, and sometimes I have to go too. She always asks for things. This time it was her summer corset and a roll of chicken wire and my trumpet so I could play for her. The joint is up on the bluffs and the tracks run next to them, so you don't see it except at the railroad gate where the walls come down to the river. And once a man in handcuffs was riding with two policemen, and one of them had a shotgun and they got off there. When we started up again, we could see out the window how they kept hold of him like a dog on a chain. But it was fastened and back to a wide belt instead of a collar. Jefferson City, the conductor says, change here for Sedalia, Knob Noster, and Warrensburg. Please remain seated until the cars come to a complete stop. Jefferson City. Where we get off is the regular station in the hollow between the bluff under the governor's house and the bluff the Capitol sits on. On the pointy top of the Capitol dome is a naked woman, but you need a telescope to get a good look at her boobies. Her name is Ceres. I have a postcard that when Dad let me buy it, he called her a strapping wench. Dad says Jeff City is a small potatoes hick town where the hillbillies and Bible thumpers and good old boys come to tell the people of St. Louis and Kansas City what to do. And that is why we have prohibition, so the gangsters and moonshiners can get rich while an honest man has to go thirsty. You can see from the yard of the governor's house across the river to the potato fields and in the bottoms. Dad and Mom know the governor from when he was lieutenant governor, and she was on a committee with him before they sent her to the joint. It is 7 blocks from the depot to the wagon gate, and the streets are named for presidents and wardens: Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, McClung, Boggs, Weyrich, and Van Buren. I'm not sure which is which. It is 7 blocks from the depot to the wagon gate, and, oh, I just read that, sorry. Dad asks if I remembered the Orangewood manicure sticks. I say, yes, sir. And the kidskin curlers? Why do I have to fetch the girl stuff? She particularly asked you, Dick. Let cats. My sister is only 2 years younger and uses lip rouge and smokes in the bathroom at school. She's not reliable. Her real name is Wilberta. And sometimes she talks back to Mom and Aunt Gertie, but more she sneaks around and does what she wants to. And when she gets caught, she pouts. She is a looker more than Mom, and already showing boobies. I am our mother's dearest, sweetest Dickie boy, and she still calls me that in front of people. And you do have her soft corset, Dad asks. Yes, sir. Most of all, I minded going in Mom's underwear drawer, but she said in her letter how Dickie boy will know where to find it. Just because once when I was little, she caught me with her drawer open, and I was holding one of her stockings against my cheek, and she asked, do you like how that feels? And I was all embarrassed and said, I don't know. She said they were silk, and she bought them at Marshall Fields. You could get the idea from her letter that I still do funny stuff like that. Until they sent her to the joint, my mom went to Chicago and Kansas City and all over giving her lectures. Aunt Gertie comes when Mom is gone, and Katz talks back and gets around her, and Vic does too. Gene tries to be a dear sweet boy like me. The twins, Eugene and Victor, are named for Mr. Debs. The first time I saw the walls at the end of the street and to think of my mom in there, I got mad because I could not help crying. And people would notice. And I was afraid when I went in to see her, they would not let me out, and I would get buggered, because they like to do it most to young boys. Mr. Zoik is a psychology professor and a friend of Mom and Dad, and he says there is a lot of that among incarcerated men. That is what Mom is, incarcerated, and it makes hardened criminals. When Mom gets out, Mr. Zoik is going with her and Dad to some cheap land in Florida that a rich man helped them buy. They are going to start Utopia, where everybody owns it all together and nobody goes hungry or has any reason to do the things they send you to the joint for. Dad is carrying the chicken wire, and I have my trumpet and the shopping bag of Mom's soft corset and the orange sticks and curlers and a paper of pins and a pair of the kind of round point scissors that little kids use for cut and paste in school. The sky is white like steam. Dad made me wear a long sleeve shirt and cap and necktie because it cheers Mom up for us to look nice. But it is more than 100 degrees, and I have prickly heat from the sweat down my back and sweat and gnats in my eyes, and the gnats whine and get up your nose. From outside, you can smell the smell of the prisoners, because a lot of them don't take baths even when they can, because they are afraid of getting buggered. I am afraid I will be in trouble for the scissors, and they will keep me in there and bugger me over and over. My mother is not a crook. She's a political. She says most of the women there are in for stealing or prostitution, and a few for murder, usually their husbands. But Gabby and Mom and Emma are politicals. Gabby is Italian and her real name Gabriella, and they caught her in Union Station with dynamite in her grip that she was carrying for her boyfriend. She is only 18 and a looker and smaller than me, although I am tall for my age. Emma is older than Mom and has a collapsed ova, so she never had babies. And she has been locked up so many times that she always carries a book to read. She says, until they convict you and send you up to the joint, there is a lot of sitting around with nothing to do except kvetch and bicker, unless you have a book to read. This time she is in for the same thing as Mom, talking against the war. Mom has this speech she gave 100 times, and BI men were following her around and taking notes. One little fellow with slick black back hair looked like a baby woodchuck, and his name was Ed Hoover. He would say, "Good morning, Mrs. O'Hare." Then when she was down in the hotel dining room, he would go up and search her bags. They arrested her in North Dakota because she said the only difference between the dead meat in the stockyards and the soldiers in France is over there you bury it. And the war turns their mothers into brood sows for Uncle Sam. They said she insulted the Gold Star mothers of America. It was the same speech she made 100 times, except Bowman is a little one-horse town between no place and nowhere. The people who came to hear her were mostly farmers, and maybe she did say it in a way the Hicks would understand. She grew up on a farm herself in Kansas. But there was this fellow who was mad at the people who invited her because they got him kicked out of his job as postmaster, and he snitched. Her trial was in Bismarck. She had a mean Catholic judge who hated her because she was a woman who didn't know her place. After they said she was guilty, she made a long speech telling Judge Wade what she thought of him, and he sentenced her to 5 years in the penitentiary. Dad says that was a big mistake, and she should have kept her mouth shut and was just trying to be a martyr. Besides being a political, she is a federal. Only they don't have any federal prisoners for women west of Pittsburgh. So they pay states to keep them. Mom, Emma, and Gabby are the only politicals. But there are other federals, mostly Indian women from reservations with diseases they got from fucking a lot of different men, like syphilis and rusty nail. Mom says they call it that because when you have it and try to pee, you feel like a rusty nail was stuck up your penis. She tries to talk to me about things like that because she is a modern mother, but I would rather find out myself from the little blue books Mr. Haldeman Julius sells. He is another friend of my parents, or used to be. Once, Mom had to wash a bathtub just after an old Indian woman with pus and blood syphilis sores took a bath in it. Some of the Indian women, though, were in for stealing or killing their husbands. Where you go in, they call it the wagon gate, but now it is bricked shut except for a regular door. You go in the door, and right in front of you are bars, floor to ceiling, blocking off the hall, and this old guard in a striped cap like an engineer is sitting on a stool by a high, slanty table, and on it is a book bigger than the preacher's Bible in church that he reads from on a stand, but not as thick. Dad says, "Hot enough for you, Henry?" You call the guard who lets you in and out, the turnkey, and he talks hillbilly. Enough you get tar on your shoe when you have to walk across the street. "Practice for where I'm headed," says Dad. "You hellbound, Mr. O'Hare?" "According to my sister, the women will take you down if you let them." "Yes, well, let's see what you brought us." Dad hands him the roll of chicken wire. "Your wife going into the egg business?" "I asked Mr. Painter." The guard nods. "I believe he knows what it is for." I hand over the shopping bag and he feels the corset with his spotty old hand as if Mom was in it. And he says, "Some of these have steel stays in them." Dad says it is a soft summer corset. The guard holds up one of the orange sticks and asks, "What's that?" "A manicure stick. Sharp on the end there. It's just wood." He takes up the paper of pins, squints at it, and puts it back. He roots around some more and takes out the scissors. Now, I don't know about these here scissors. It's just little kid scissors like they use in school, I say. A woman can take them apart, sharpen the blade, just rubbing on the concrete. She wants them for sewing, Dad says. He puts them back in the bag. Excuse me. Now, what have you got there, Sonny? I hand him my trumpet. He opens the case and takes it out and holds it up by his ear and shakes it and works the valves. Looks in the mouth of the horn, puts it down, and says, no. I can take just my instrument and leave the case. It's not allowed. The fellow over there will give you a ticket. Dad nudges me not to argue. I put my trumpet on the counter, and the other guard puts it in a basket that he sets on a shelf with a lot of other baskets that mostly have handbags in them, and gives me a ticket. Then I sign in a big register book after Dad. I look up at the Roman number clock with the time in instead of just copying his. Henry takes a stamper with a little toothed wheel like at the library, and he stamps it on his ink pad, then on the back of Dad's left hand, then mine, and we go through the turnstile gate. Without a stamp on your hand, they won't let you out. A guard with an iron key, big as your hand, opens a barred gate into the alley behind a high brick building and a low stone building. At the end is a newer building with a tower over the door that looks like Sumner High School, where I will start in the fall. And that is the Department of Female Convicts. Mom says they have 300 women in the joint with 2,000 men. When I asked if that is because women don't do bad things as much, she said, not entirely. Aunt Gertie takes a switch to Victor and me and lets cats get away with murder. Mom says Victor looks up to me and I must always be a good influence. The matron looks funny at the chicken wire but doesn't say anything, and another woman guard takes us up the iron steps like pieces of pie that go round and round a pole. The smell is like Grandpa's feedlot. Inside is just as hot as outside, but steamy, and the air not moving at all. And for a minute, I think I'm going to puke. But the gnats are gone, and it is not so bad when you breathe in through your mouth. You come off the stairs onto the catwalk, and the cells are all on one side, and just a railing on the other, with open space all the way down to the concrete by the floor-to-ceiling windows. So if you don't like somebody, you can push her over and watch her smash. Mom thinks the other woman prisoners all like her because she helps them write letters and gives them treats from the food people send her. But they love Emma because she listens to their problems and hugs them. Emma is an anarchist, and she believes in free love and blowing things up with dynamite, so we have to start all over again. But Mom and Dad and Mr. Debs, by the way, there is a young woman named Emma here tonight who is named after a character in this story. But I trust she will not have a life entirely like her namesake. I don't think that's what her parents had in mind. But there's much admirable about her namesake, as you will see in this story. Or some of you well may know. Okay. So much for that digression. But they love Emma because she listens to their problems and hugs them. Okay, I've already read that part. So, but Mom and Dad and Mr. Debs believe you can get people to vote for utopia. They aren't anarchists. They were political socialists. And stuffed shirt New York Reds like Mr. Hillquit, who are jealous, call them hicks and yellow dogs. Emma and Gabby are very nice people, though, nicer than Mom. Mom's cell is 8 feet wide with just bars on the side toward the catwalk and iron the other three sides. She has a skinny bed, a chair, a little table, and a toilet. There is a window high up in the back wall, too little to crawl out. I don't feel any breeze, but you can hear a train from outside, then birds. She has pictures of us and her friends and of Ruskin in Florida, where we will start Utopia. They are stuck to the walls the way Gabby showed her with chewing gum. Emma and Gabby are not in their cells next to Mom's. Most of the prisoners are out in the upper yard for their Sunday afternoon recreation. They work all week, 10 hours a day, plus Saturday morning in the overalls factory, and they have a quota that Emma can't make because she has bad eyes. So Mom and the other women do extra for her. Mom calls it a sweatshop. She says it forces them to be scabs against the union garment workers and against honest bosses who pay taxes. Mom is sitting in her striped dress in her chair with her hands in her lap, staring straight ahead and the cell door open. She barely looks up when we come in. She turns her cheek when Dad bends down to kiss her, and when I try to hug her, she gives me a pat on the back. Dad says, "Dick brought the wire." She just nods. I unroll the chicken wire on the bunk and take the pieces of twine I already cut out of my pocket. Mom doesn't say anything while Dad and me spread the bigger piece of wire against the bars from the side walls to the doorway and tie it tight with twine. Then we take the small pieces and tie it on the bars of the bottom half of the sliding door. "Thank you," Mom says. I stand back and look at it. The roll of chicken wire was 4 feet wide and only comes up that high from the floor. I say, "They can climb in over the top, Mom." "We'll bring more wire next time," Dad says. "They come in for the food," says Mom. People all over the country send her food, and she keeps it on the little shelves Dad brought in. She shares it with the poor women who don't have much education or people sending them things. She has guava paste, gefilte fish, pickled little carrots and cauliflower, peanut butter, cookies, brownies, and matzah. The rats come to get the food. One ran across her face and woke her up, and that is when Dad promised to ask permission for the wire. Mom is allowed only one letter out per week. She pretends it is to me and Katz and Vic and Jean and Dad, as if he wasn't coming to see her all the time. The letters are really for the people who send her things, though, and for the people who write to her and go to meetings to get her and the other politicals out of jail, like Emma and Mr. Debs. She will say, "Be sure to thank Teresa Malkiel or Teresa Malkiewicz for the gefilte fish, and thank Edna Gellhorn for the petition drive, and thank Mr. Zoik for the book he sent." Then Dad mimeographs the letter and sends it out to the people she is thanking and a lot of other people besides, more than 200. And I have to address the envelopes, and Katz is supposed to help me, but she gets out of it. Mom tells the truth in the letters, but Dad keeps saying for her not to write mean things about people or sound sorry for herself. Sometimes he cuts out parts or changes words, and she gets mad, and they argue. Before they sent her to the joint, she was the big star, touring everywhere like an opera singer to give lectures. And Dad was her manager, booking her dates and collecting her pay from subscriptions to their newspaper, the Ripsaw. The way your club got her to come give a lecture, or got Mr. Debs, or got Mr. Tickner, or Mr. Ammeringer, the funny German, or Mrs. Stokes, was you sold 1,000 subscriptions to the Ripsaw. Just before I was born, Dad took her to the Hall of Electricity at the St. Louis World's Fair, and he made her listen to herself on the dictaphone and taught her not to let her voice turn high and squeaky when she got excited. Mom just sits there, staring out past us. Dad asks, "What happened to your hand?" Her left hand is wrapped in a handkerchief and a dirty bandage. "It's the heat," she says. "Your hand? In the shop, I passed out from the heat." He has to nag and pry to get the story out of her. They work in the old twine plant, and all the windows are nailed shut to keep them from flirting with the men prisoners and not a breath of air. There is one electric fan that the matron keeps turned on herself. In the heat, Mom collapsed and she had a fever, but the next day they sent her back to work and she fainted at her machine again, and her foot was on the pedal and it kept running and the needle went in her hand. She lets Dad untie the handkerchief and pull back the bandage pad. Around the little holes in the web of her thumb is red and swelled up, and her skin is hot. That's infected, he says. She sighs. Has the doctor seen it? She shakes her head. Did a doctor see you for your heat exhaustion? No. I'm going to paint her about this. It won't do any good. We'll see. He gets up and asks if I can hold down the fort with Mom a few minutes and cheer her up. Mr. Painter is the warden, and he is in his office on Sundays so people visiting prisoners can come see him. But you have to wait a long time for your turn, like a doctor's office. I was afraid Dad would be there so long that visiting hours would be over and I would have to get out by myself, or they wouldn't let me out, and the prisoners would get a hold of me and bugger me, like Father Amel did to Victor when Aunt Gertie let him go to the choir camp. Mom will not talk to me. I stand by her chair and she puts her arms around my waist, and the way she is crying scares me. It is not crying to make you feel sorry for her, but like bleeding inside, and nothing you can say or do will stop it. I look over her shoulder up to the slit window in the wall just below the ceiling. I can hear the twit, twit, twittering of the birds that fly high late in the afternoon catching bugs. When Dad finally comes back, he is all red in the face. He is so mad when he talks that spit flies all over, and she is just clinging to me and crying. Painter won't let you see a doctor because of the letters. He goes on and on about how the warden did not come out and say it, but the reason is that she makes him look bad, as if he deliberately mistreats the poor women in his evil, filthy joint. A reporter from the fat New York newspaper they take at the Ripsaw offices where I have to work after school wants to talk to her, and a federal prison inspector is coming. Then Dad notices Mom is not paying attention, and he asks, "What's wrong with you?" She just shakes her head. "Did you hear a word I was saying?" She barely nods. He has just been to Chicago and Washington, D.C., talking to important people for her, and he needs to tell her things. I try to loosen Mom's arms around my waist and get her to listen to Dad. I saw Steady in Chicago. Mr. Stedman was supposed to be Mom's lawyer, but he was the lawyer for Mr. Debs, too, and Mr. Emmeringer, and Mr. Berger, and Mrs. Stokes, and so many other politicals that he forgot about her until the last day she could appeal, and she blames him for being in the joint. He's been studying up on your trial, and he says this time he will do his best for you. Mom looks up. As if she were not so tired and blue, she would make a smart answer. He says the judge was prejudiced and shouldn't have been allowed to hear the case. The jury was half bankers and the rest businessmen from the town, not one farmer or working man among them. Your attorney should have been able to bring in the local political feud. He said, of course, your speech before sentencing didn't help. Mom shakes her head. They argued about this before. He's filing briefs on behalf of you, Jean, Rose Stokes, and a group of church women in Chicago is lobbying for you and Rose through Colonel House. Steady says maybe we can get to the chief by that route. Fat chance, Mom said. He found a fellow named Bettman in Justice who thinks the case against you was weak. He even said, Steady has a copy of a memo he wrote to Palmer, I feel skeptical about sending her to the penitentiary. And when he was flogging his report around the department, the Solicitor General, Alex King, he lumped you with Rose. He said the worst that could be said of you was that you're two ill-advised, brilliant women with highly emotional natures and a great lack of the saving grace of common sense. I think I'm going to vomit. Steady said sending a respectable woman with four children to the penitentiary for making a speech makes them look bad, and they know it. He said they're looking for a way out, a way that lets them. I know what you're leading up to, Frank, Mom says, and the answer is no. Will you let me finish? I step away from Mom. She is listening now. So I went on to D.C. that night, and first thing in the morning I go to the AG's office. I was ready for a long wait to camp in his office until he saw me. But I didn't have to. When I said I came straight from a Chicago meeting with Seymour Stedman, it was just a matter of minutes. Well, A. Mitchell Palmer must weigh 300 pounds. When he gets up, it is like a hog standing on its hind legs. He's handsome, in a way, and a time server and a stuffed shirt. We got to the point. I said, I just came from a meeting with Seymour Stedman. He already knew that, but I wanted it to be fresh in his mind. That's good, Palmer said. You're here on behalf of your wife and Debs and Mrs. Stokes, not as a journalist for that. What is the little red rag you put out in St. Louis? I curbed the urge to pop him one in the kisser and say, the rip saw. So I can speak freely, and I interrupted, but suppose I want to write an editorial on, or an article on this business. Oh, that'll be all right, Palmer says, if you'll submit the piece to me for approval first. I shrugged, and we were off. He wasn't going to get hung up on this. He's had a belly full of the criticism over locking you up, and once and out, I was heaven sent. I was his stooge. You can go straight back to Missouri, he says, and tell your wife she can get her freedom if she will do just one thing. Say she is sorry and promise not to do it again. Let me tell you,